Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debates recorded live in New York. After listening to the world's leading authorities sharing surprising facts and reasoned analysis, you just might rethink your point of view on some big issues. Find Intelligence Squared U.S. on iTunes under podcasts. And that is the music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. Not just any Pop Culture Happy Hour, but a very special episode. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here in the studio with Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
Stephen, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
So before we get started, we did have a piece of news, did we not, Stephen?
Yeah, I don't even know how to feel about it.
Yeah, the tickets for our New York show, which will be on August 19th, went on sale, and they were gone real fast.
Okay, our last show in D.C. sold out in 2 minutes, and we kind of went around like, oh, yeah, we sold out in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
These sold out in 10 seconds.
Way to go, New York.
So thank you, New York.
Thank you, New York.
Future.
Thank you, Cleveland.
Yeah. Future live shows, we hereby promise bigger room.
We're trying to get we're trying to do a better job with the match of supply and demand so that hopefully more of you who want to come and see the show can come see the show, because we definitely want to see you. So thanks to everybody who bought tickets, and sorry to those who weren't able to.
Yeah, we really genuinely apologize to those who tried, especially people who had their finger on the button at what they thought was 11:58 and couldn't get tickets.
We have received the message.
We have received that we have done.
And we appreciate it. As far as this week's show, well, Stephen and I are here to introduce a special episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, the one specifically that we recorded recently. Where were we, Stephen?
The San Diego Comic-Con, which we recorded on July 24th.
That's absolutely right. We were in one of the lovely panel rooms there in the convention center, very crowded place, and we had a lovely turnout of people. There was a phantom thumping that was happening a little bit in the room.
I think it's the ghost of Jack Kirby.
I think it was the ghost of Jack Kirby. I personally think it happened because our producer, Jessica, was not with us.
Basically, all the way through this entire recording, you will hear what sounds like this. I can't decide if it's a thump or a bonk.
Yeah, you'll get used to it. Hopefully you won't. We just wanted to let you know that we know.
And we didn't notice the constant thumping.
And we weren't keeping any rogue cosplayers under the table.
Not that I know of.
We didn't have anyone under there trying to get out. It was just one of those things that happens.
Yeah, it sounds like somebody's hitting the table. That's not what it is.
But you'll also get to hear some audience questions. You'll get to hear a chat with Maggie about inclusivity and exclusivity in nerd culture, and you'll get to hear Glenn.
You will hear an epic quiz.
You will. You'll hear an epic quiz from Glenn with an epic conclusion. We will be back next week.
All right, hold on. I want to ease people into the show.
We will be back next week with a regular episode. We'll be talking actually about Guardians of the Galaxy next week. And until then, we invite you to enjoy our Comic-Con panel. You know, one thing that sometimes happens when we're trying to do something that's different from what we normally do is we forget something that we're supposed to do. And one thing we were supposed to do is we're planning on sending this out as an episode of the podcast. We're not 100% sure if that's going to work. And we forgot a notice that we were supposed to post outside.
I forgot.
I'm trying to help you. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to read it. I don't know if that will work. And that way, hopefully, it'll be okay. And if not, then this will be a special thing just for you, and no one will ever hear it. And it'll be a secret just between us. But I'm going to read it now, and you'll be impressed with how hilarious it is. This event is being recorded by National Public Radio, Inc. for distribution as a podcast. The event may include a segment where you will be able to participate by directing questions to the panel. By participating in this event, you hereby irrevocably grant to NPR the perpetual worldwide royalty-free, sub-licensable, and transferable right, license, and privilege to use, publish, edit, modify, excerpt, promote, broadcast, and otherwise disseminate any audio recording made of you during this event and whole or in part, including making derivative works in any manner and for any purpose, including but not limited to news, information, publicity, promotions, and marketing, and in any media, whether now known or hereafter developed. By participating in this event, you waive any rights to a payment and or to inspect and approve any audio recording taken by NPR, and you release NPR from any liability connected with the audio recording or publication of the event. You're not going to hear the music at the beginning because, like, we don't have it, and do I want to hold up my phone to the thing? No, that seems... That seems like going farther down a hole of sadness. All right, so I'm going to take a deep breath, and we'll start. Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, live from San Diego Comic-Con. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. Today, we're going to take a cue from our surroundings and talk about some of the ups and downs of sharing the things you love. Then we'll battle each other for a hard-fought victory, and we'll close with our regular final topic, what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here, in extremely historic room 32AB... By the way, this is by far the most people who have ever been in costume at a pop culture happy hour. Let's introduce everybody. Next to me is Glenn Weldon. Glenn, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Thompson. Stephen, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And next to Stephen, as you may know, Maggie Thompson is Stephen's mother. Nepotism. Someone is committing nepotism here, but I don't actually know who it is.
Ordinarily, by the way, my contract at NPR stipulates that I never have to sit this close to my mother.
I got nothing here, guys. I got nothing.
Maggie, why don't you explain your credentials, which are far greater than any of ours.
I started collecting comics when I was 4. That's it. Yeah.
And later...
Then I wrote about comics for many years, and I edited Comics Buyer's Guide, and I now do a blog for Comic-Con, and I do a weekly thing for the Diamond Scoop newsletter.
All right, mom's done talking.
It was my fault. It was my fault.
She almost single-handedly created comic book fandom. Is that fair?
Well, I had 2 kids, and they didn't read that many comics once they grew up.
Rebellion.
Maggie is a luminary, is what we're trying to say. Luminary Maggie Thompson, who was kind enough to include us in her participation this year in Comic-Con. And we're all very happy to be here with Maggie, because without her, like, we'd be doing this. So what we were going to talk about, you know, as we've been walking around this environment, which, oh, by the way, you know, we were going to start by also explaining, you know, some of us have different histories with Comic-Con. I personally not only have never been to Comic-Con before, despite being a pop culture writer, but used to say, I will never go to Comic-Con. And it has nothing to do with all of you delightful people. It has to do with my paralyzing fear of crowds, noise, and claustrophobia. So, I'm doing great so far, by the way, but this is my first Comic-Con. How about you, Glenn?
It's my second. You know, last year I noticed that this is a space of unbridled enthusiasm, which, if you are a small, petty, cynical person, can creep you out. Because enthusiasm needs a bridle, I think. Put a bit in that mouth.
And you're here to be that bride.
But I was talking to somebody on the floor this morning, and I found myself looking around. I couldn't figure out why. It's because I keep expecting it's a trap, and that the jocks are going to descend on us, and there's going to be this Axe body spray that comes in. We're going to be shoved into lockers.
Yeah.
They're going to build some lockers and shove us into it.
But no.
Hall H is there. Hall I, one big locker.
Exactly.
That's where they just herd everybody in.
So, yes, Steven.
Steven, have you been to Comic-Con before?
Yes. I went to Comic-Con in 1976.
I just heard a whistle.
I was about to turn 4. And my greatest memory of that time, I remember I had a really delicious ice cream cone. I assumed all along that that's what Comic-Con was. So the costumes confuse and terrify me.
Right. There's still food here, by the way. Maggie, how long have you been coming to Comic-Con?
I don't know the count. For our first one was 1976.
Oh, mine too.
Coincidentally, my son and my daughter. This is, by the way, the first Comic-Con since 1976 when my son and my daughter and I are all here together at the same convention. So in 1983, Don and I took over editorship of Comics Buyer's Guide.
Don is Maggie's late husband and my late father.
Sorry. This is true. There's a hushed moment of silence because nobody knows how to react to that, but that's okay. But I have been coming to San Diego Comic-Con off and on since 1983 and perpetually since 1994.
Fantastic. And if you walk around with Maggie, you will quickly learn that she knows everyone.
Yep.
It is impossible to walk from one place to another with Maggie at Comic-Con.
I actually don't recommend it.
Yeah. So what we did want to talk about, as we were sort of taking all of this in, one of the things we wanted to talk about was this fundamental tension between the fact that this environment is so great for people to be with other people who love the things that they love and to share all that stuff. And it also has this kind of that tension between sharing and then also sort of closing a little bit to making it something that's an inclusive thing versus a slightly, not exclusive in the bad way, but something that kind of is identifying to you. So I was going to ask Glenn, you've been writing this book about fan culture. How do you think this kind of plays out, this tension between insiders enjoying the status of being insiders versus, you know, being joined by others?
Right. Well, before I started writing the book, I had a very clear line in my head between nerds and hipsters. Nerds love the thing they love deeply, passionately, profoundly. What makes them nerds is their desire to share it with others. I love this thing. I want you to love this thing. Here it is, even if you have shown no interest in it. Here it is. Hipsters say, I found this thing. It's mine. It's ours, actually. Let's pick three or four of our best friends, and we're going to own it, and we are going to resent the hell out of anybody who comes along later. Funny story. There is a thread of nerddom which says, and we've talked about this on the show before, if you don't like the thing that I like in exactly the same way, for the same reasons, and to the extent that I like it, you're doing it wrong. So there is a thread of hipsterism in nerd culture, which... I'll pass it along to Stephen now, but there's more to say about that, about how that's, I think, changing. I think things like cosplay and fan fiction are widening the base, making nerdery better, making comic culture better, but we'll pass it along to Stephen.
No, I mean, I was raised by nerds. I mean, there's no other way around it. I've been saying that since before, I don't know, that would be...
Before you got out of grade school.
Yeah, exactly. Like, my parents are horrible, horrible nerds. I said it all the time. And now I can say it to your face.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so I've had it deeply, almost literally bred into me that sharing is part of the most fun thing that you can do as a fan of something, and proselytizing endlessly. But I do sometimes find with things that... And maybe this is the hipster within. I do sometimes... I have no hipster within.
You're right about music. There's a hipster within.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. That there comes a point, I find, where I'm a fan of something, and I'm really excited about pushing it along and getting more people into it. And then there comes a point at which it's pushed a little bit beyond, everyone likes it, and I just kind of... Then it's time to hang back. The fandom doesn't feel quite as personal. That's the only way that I would defend, you know, hipsters. Nobody defends hipsters, by the way. Hipster
you're
is,
defending what Glenn is calling hipsters.
Right. Hipster
which is
a
desire for some kind of ownership.
But hipster is very often a straw man. You've at least defined it.
Right.
That's the only area where I have felt a little bit of what you describe, where it's like, okay, now everyone loves... There's Archer pillows out in the convention center. I don't necessarily need to be telling everybody about Archer all the time anymore.
I mean, I guess part of what I get from what Glenn is saying, and also from my sense of this, is that really loving something culture-wise, you both become an advocate for it, but it also is very, very identifying to you. It becomes part of people's identity, and I think there's a way in which... I think the public perception of people using culture to self-identify can be very negative. It can be an idea of, like, you shouldn't identify yourself as a person who loves that thing. But people identify themselves as people who love rock climbing and photography and
sports.
All kinds of other stuff and sports. Yeah. Glenn always wants to be like, sports.
Exactly.
And sports. And it's not... There's nothing wrong with, I think, understanding that what you love culturally, the books you love, the music you love... is a part of your identity. And I think part of what happens is that things become more and more popular, sometimes because of the success of the part of you that's advocating and that's sharing, as they become more popular, they become less potent as ways to define yourself. Because there was a time, like, with any band that goes from being a really small band to a really hugely popular band, aside from the whole kind of somewhat phony sellout business that goes on, those conversations... There is a way in which if you like the same really obscure band as someone else, that is a way in which you and that person have something fairly small in common that's fairly specific, Whereas once that band becomes hugely popular, then it's kind of like you never know where that person came to it or how they got it. It's the difference between if somebody had told you 10 years ago that they were an Iron Man person versus right. now. It just means something different. It's not that one is better or worse. It's just something different.
Now it's like, wow, you can quote The Simpsons? Good job.
Yeah. Yeah. Maggie, very often in these conversations, I find it very valuable to talk to you and have you sort of remind us that none of this is new. And I'm always kind of curious about that perspective. And I know none of it is new, but what is your read on that?
Well, there are two points I would make. One is when Don died, there were all these tributes that said, oh, he's in heaven now with Jack Kirby. And, you know, and I'm going, okay, so he's also in heaven with, you know, Theodore Sturgeon and so forth and so on, because people only know you through one aspect of the many interests you have. And Don and I met through science fiction fandom, and we loved old-time radio. And the first day we met, we were talking about the fact that he'd seen movie serials and I hadn't. And we both grew up with radio, but there were different things that we liked together. So popular culture, before the term popular culture existed, is what drove us and brought us together. The second point that I would make is that I first saw Doctor Who in a hotel room in Denver. And I was like, wow, what is this show? This is really weird, and I want to know more about it. And it was basically only on in England and a couple of local TV stations. So I made posters in our local comic shop right to WVIZ to get Doctor Who on. And we actually got Doctor Who on in Cleveland Television because I kept making signs, and the comic shop kept promoting it. And they
Luminary.
Got Badger. And that... I was asked to edit a magazine called Doctor Who, and I said, you can't do that. The BBC will break your legs. But we can call it Fantasy Empire and do it on science fiction and fantasy in the British Empire. And our cover feature every month will be, guess what? And so what happened was I observed the Doctor Who fandom grow in the late 1970s. And what it was here is this tiny pool, and the 150 of us know it and love it. And the bigger the pool got, the more people started to hate each other. My favorite doctor is John Pertwee. You think so? Well, I'm just saying the scarf that I knit is better. And so suddenly this hobby that nobody cared about was divided immediately. Now, it can be claimed that this is nerds. I claim it's people. And this is why you have the third church of the resurrection. Because the first two churches of the resurrection, the flowers on the altar were wrong. So is it not people?
That does sound like nerds. That does sound like something nerds would do. I cannot tell a lie. That sounds like church nerds. Well, you know, it is an amazing thing. Like, and I've been tweeting a little bit about this, but I'm not a hugely familiar sci-fi person or a comics person, which at this event means I walk around looking at a lot of people going, that is probably such an awesome costume, and I have no idea what it is. My triumph, which I did mention on Twitter, was the guy that I looked at it, and I was like, that is Thomas the Tank Engine. And I was like, no, that is Battlestar Galactica. And I'm pretty sure it was actually neither of those things. And so the weird thing about it is it gives you that feeling of like, it's so cool to be around these people who love things, but the costumes are sort of inherently like, they present in this way that's like, if you don't know what the thing is, you're not like welcomed in, not because the person is being off-putting, but just because you can't relate. And no matter how much you perhaps love the idea. I was trying to describe a costume earlier. I was like, there were foam legs and it was really cool. But you can't really appreciate it in the same way because you don't have the familiarity. And well, it is kind of one of those inside-outside things.
Well, and the fandoms all... I mean, I'm not the first person in this room to notice this, but the fandoms all overlap.
Yeah. Oh,
like,
of course.
Everything's on top of each other, so the fans of anything in pop culture are here. And yeah, it is hard to identify everything.
Well, and I'll also now split into the snottiness of the I know what it truly is and you don't understand it at all, is you use the term sci-fi. And I've got to tell you that it's science fiction because sci-fi was created by Fory Ackerman and is popular because of Famous Monsters of Filmland.
This is this is what it's like to hang out with Maggie.
It is. Seriously. Oh, no. This is almost 42 years of my life.
Yeah, you've heard yourself, I think.
It's not pronounced science fiction.
Yeah. You know, back...
I can't see her, but I know she's down there going, well, it's not.
Back in the 60s with the Batman comic, there were fans, and Maggie probably knew many of them. And then when the television show came on, there was this movement that happens between, hey, there's a new, oh my God, what the hell is this? This is not what we want. A lot of the letters I found of people who were Batman fans complaining about the 1966 television show weren't so much about the show, it's about the people who come up to them and say, hey, Batman, groovy, right? They weren't prepared for that. They weren't prepared to have anything that they loved considered, God forbid, hip.
Yeah. And there's like a little bit of something poisonous about that for some people. Like, that's, I don't want my thing to be, you know, hip meaning mainstream in a way, because it's not.
So one of Maggie's favorite things to say is nothing new under the sun. Yeah. And so that's exactly what this is going on here.
I think that is what we've come around to.
Although actually what's new from my perspective is 800 gazillion people in an entire town with flags to it.
Yeah, well, there's that.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Perhaps this is a good time to segue to the other thing that is not new under the sun, which is now not new under the sun, which is Glenn kicking our butts in quizzes.
I am shamed in advance.
Yeah. So we asked Glenn to prepare a quiz for us, in which, if you've heard any of the other ones, I'm not sure I've ever gotten a question right in a quiz of Glenn's.
One. You've gotten one right. One.
Oh, good for me then.
All right. So it is the 75th anniversary of Batman. People are making a lot of deal about that all over. There's all kinds of panels and everything. That's great. But you know who's not getting the attention he deserves is somebody whose 75th anniversary is coming up, and that's Robin, the Boy Wonder. His presence changed Superhero Comics forever. Now all of a sudden there was this vogue to put little children in mortal danger. And it, from a tactical perspective, from a crime-fighting perspective, it doesn't make any sense. From a marketing sense, it's great, because it means that you now have a proxy for your audience of very young children who read, somebody who's like hanging out with Batman. You also have, from an editorial perspective, somebody for the hero to explain everything to. So you have a Watson all of a sudden for him to say, here's my thinking, here's why it happened. So this is not just about Robin. This is about the vogue for superhero sidekicks that Robin touched off. In all their weird, weird glory.
The great thing about doing this at Comic-Con is that we can actually see people's derision firsthand. Like, when we don't know, like, I'm just going to, the thoughts in your head, I'm going to hear, you didn't know that?
Oh, okay, Stephen.
That's true.
You think you're going to get the derision?
Oh, that's true. Nobody expects me to know.
That's right. Now, let me just, before we start the quiz, Glenn.
Yeah.
The expert is the person who knows whom to ask. Had I Googled by my side, I would cream this quiz.
All right.
Okay?
All right. Okay, that's cheating. You can't do that. I'm just trying to remember, as I try to answer these questions, this thing right in front of me that says, please be aware that many members of your audience may be under 18 years of age. So if I get angry...
All right, I'm restrained now.
Linda Holmes, question number one. A production error occurred in the April 1940 comic that introduced Robin the Boy Wonder to the world.
Yeah, it did.
What was it? So there's going to be thrown a lot of information at you, so process. A... Robin's gloves were colored yellow, not green, if you can imagine. B, Batman and Robin's word balloons were reversed, which made Robin seem like a really bossy little twerp, and Batman naive and weirdly cheery. C, the panel showing Robin's parents' actual death was mistakenly deleted, so the casual reader could well assume that Batman had just kidnapped young. Or D, the caption that introduced Robin, which read, "The Batman takes under his protecting mantle an ally in his relentless fight against crime," was missing the space between the words "n" and "ally." So it read... "The Batman takes under his protecting mantle anally in his relentless fight against crime." So, gloves... word balloons... Batman kidnap Robin, protecting mental.
And the other one, yeah. Gloves.
the Batman takes under his protecting mantle angelly in his relentless fight against crime. Look it up. Google it.
I should have known you wouldn't make that up.
I actually knew that one because Linda did not have the advantage I did of Maggie Thompson going, "It's the one."
Well, I'm 0 for 1. Yep. That's nothing new. Move along.
Steven, the original Human Torch, the Golden Age Human Torch, of course.
Oh, thank you.
Was an android with a human boy sidekick who was introduced in fall 1940, who, even though he was a human boy, could also burst into flame and fly, because comics.
Right.
What was his name? A, Torchy. B, Toro. C, Zippo. D, Lil Flamer.
You know what, man? I'm just going all in on this. Lil Flamer.
Would that it were so.
Ah!
Toro. Because Toro means bull, and bulls catch fire. Maggie Thompson. Aquaman's sidekick, Aqualad, was banished from Atlantis as an infant and left to die. Why? A, he had been born out of wedlock. B, he was prophesied to become king of Atlantis. C, he had purple eyes. D, his father, an undersea mafioso type, slept with the fishes.
This is a guess, but I'm thinking B.
B was prophesied to become king. I'm sorry, it was because he had purple eyes. Purple
Why
eyes.
Why did I not know this? I should. Shame. Did that get changed later?
Linda Holmes.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
Again, score check.
No appeals.
The Fawcett comic character Captain Marvel, also mistakenly called Shazam, had a sidekick, Captain Marvel Jr., who possessed a very weird and very specific limitation. What was it? A, he possessed all of Captain Marvel's abilities except the wisdom of Solomon, because he was younger. B, he could only become Captain Marvel Jr. at times when Captain Marvel was not in his hero identity. C, if he ever told anyone his name, he would change back into his own secret identity. Or D, he was allergic to shellfish.
The one about telling people your name and changing back to your secret identity.
Absolutely correct. That's one for Linda.
Mom knew that one too.
That's all I needed.
I got three fingers going on.
That's all I needed.
Captain Marvel Jr. would turn into Captain Marvel Jr. by saying the name of his hero, which was Captain Marvel. So that meant he couldn't tell anybody his name, otherwise he would turn back to Freddie Freeman. So he called himself CM3 for a while. Didn't make any sense,
no,
but he did.
Doesn't.
Okay, Stephen. Yankee Doodle Jones was a flag-draped... Just the name, really? Just was a flag-draped World War II superhero stitched together from the corpses of World War I soldiers.
True or false? False!
The hero's name was Yankee Doodle Jones, so what was his sidekick's name? A, Uncle Sam. B, Dandy. C, Diddle. D, Macaroni.
I'm going to go with B, Dandy.
Absolutely correct.
That is the first quiz question I have gotten right since October of 2011.
Yep.
I don't actually know that that's true, but it has been a long time.
That is not true.
Maggie Thompson, the Golden Age hero Silver Streak, the world's fastest man, took in an orphan boy from the streets and got himself a sidekick in that process. In the panel in which he became his sidekick, what did Silver Streak say to his sidekick? A, I will train you now in the secret ways of running very fast. B, it's too fantastic. The same freak accident that birthed me. It happened also to you. C, don't ask questions, step into the machine. Or D, I'm proud that you've passed the physical test and are now ready for an injection of my secret fluid.
I have to think that if it were the last of those, that would be a meme by now. I'm thinking the second one. I really don't know.
I'm proud that you've passed the physical test and are now ready for an injection of my secret fluid. Look it up,
guys.
Look it up,
meme. Spread the word.
Maggie has given it to the world.
Okay, so we're tied 1-1.
Yeah,
1-1, and the one who does not have a one,
I will just point out here, he's given me the hard ones because I do.
It's true.
Stephen, we're taking down the luminary.
All right.
Yeah.
One more question for each of you. Linda, the Western superhero known only as the Vigilante, had a sidekick called what crazily racist thing? A, Pie Face. B, Sambo. C, Stuff the Chinatown Kid. Or D, Asso.
I'm going to say Asso.
Stuff the Chinatown Kid. Stephen Thompson. Captain Marvel had several Lieutenant Marvels.
Sure.
Which of these was not among them? Not among his Lieutenant Marvels? A, Tall Marvel. B, Fat Marvel. C, Small Marvel. D, Hillbilly Marvel.
I'm gonna go Fat Marvel.
Small Marvel. Ugh.
And I know that one too. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Ooh, boy.
Maggie, what was different about the superhero sidekick introduced in 1941 named Stripesy? A, he was the only adult sidekick to a kid superhero. B, he was the first transgender character in comics. C, he was the first reluctant superhero in comics. D, he was a zebra.
A.
A is correct. We have a three-way tie.
Now,
the Star-Spangled Kid and Stripesy. Yes.
The Star-Spangled Kid, exactly.
I just want to point out what this proves is that Maggie Thompson, her son Stephen, and Linda Holmes, equal knowledge of comic books. One each.
Yeah.
Have we time for a tie-breaking lightning round?
We can do it. It won't take long. I'll lose so fast.
Okay, Maggie, you start. Name a sidekick. Any sidekick.
Well, we've already done Stripesy, Captain Marvel.
One.
So you're saying people we've already done?
But we can be anybody.
Well, Robin.
Stripesy.
Stripesy.
Oh, she said Stripesy.
Do we count Mary Marvel, considering that we're just...
Oh. Then I'm going to say Mary Marvel.
I thought she just...
Go.
Captain Marvel Jr.
Yep.
The Suzuki sidekick. Mm. The car.
The T-Mobile sidekick.
Harley Quinn.
Harley Quinn, sure.
Fallout Boy.
Good.
The Stuff the Chinatown... Stuff the Chinatown lad. Boy. Person. Kid.
Woozy. Woozy Winks.
Aqualad.
I do not know.
Okay.
Oh, this is a
Maggie, go.
Battle of Titans.
3 seconds, Maggie. 3 seconds. Three.
Superboy, because I'm sorry, he's not, no, because he's in the Legion and the whatever.
No, he's on the sidekick.
Do we do Lana Lang? Do we do Jimmy Olsen?
No. Nope, sorry. What?
Why we'll not go. Jimmy Olsen?
See, Jimmy Olsen's fine. You said three things before you said that.
Okay. Jimmy Olsen.
All right. Stephen Thompson. It pains me to say it. But you are the winner of the
that
sidekick quiz.
That was completely legitimate in every way.
Yep.
Thank you, Glenn, for that wonderful quiz. You are a genius, as always.
Heck.
And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Maggie Thompson, end of the row. Other than losing to Steven, what is making you happy?
Comic-Con is making me happy is the obvious answer, but one of the facets of this is that I am moderating a panel on strong female characters. And when I went to WISCON, which is a science fiction convention, in the spring, I said, I'm so out of comic books. What do you recommend? And they said, you need to read Saga, said the retailer. So I bought the first three trade paperbacks right there and then, and they were sitting on my shelf, as everything does, and then I discovered I was going to moderate a panel with Brian K. Vaughan and Fiona Staples, and so I read Saga, and oh my gosh.
Yep.
So that's what's making me happy this week, is I get to be a fangirl to people who are on a panel I'm moderating. But everybody should be reading Saga, because it's fantastic.
Agreed.
Three Eisner Awards.
Stephen Thompson.
Well, for some reason, I am fascinated with people who can carve out long careers doing bizarre things that shouldn't be jobs. And so I took a special amount of delight in a little press release, that news item and press release, not interchangeable, but I received word that, and this is total pandering to a Comic-Con crowd, but that the new album by Weird Al Yankovic, not only was his first ever number one album, but that it broke all of his previously existing sales records for a week. Now, for those of you who haven't been following the collapse of the music industry, that is an incredibly remarkable thing. Weird Al Yankovic has a new album out called Mandatory Fun, and every few years, I've been a Weird Al fan since I was 11 or 12, and I've gotten to witness, like, every few years, a new generation comes up, discovers that they love Weird Al Yankovic, and the previous generation that discovered that discovers that they really loved Weird Al Yankovic, and the generation before that is like, yeah, I still love Weird Al Yankovic. And I love the fact that that man, who is a mensch, has been in this business for something like 35 years and continues to be more popular than ever, doing wacky song parodies. And just nothing could make me happier than the latest Yankazants, of which this is like, you're just in the front row, I just see a shaking head. Of which this is like number 11, and I'm just delighted. Weird Al Yankovic, he is at Comic-Con doing a bunch of stuff on Saturday.
Fantastic. Thank you, Stephen. Glenn Weldon.
By applause, how many of you are watching Penny Dreadful? This show was built in a secret underground lab engineered for me. Okay, so basically it's characters from Frankenstein and Dracula and the Picture of Dorian Gray working together, team up a bag of misfits and a gang of misfits in 1991 London, Victorian, blah, blah, blah. I didn't watch it because I thought something that I think often, which is comics did it better. League of Extraordinary Gentlemen did it better. There's no reason for me to watch this show. The movie did it much worse. The comic did it much better. I watch it, and it's just so good. It's got this tone. It knows exactly what it is and what it wants to do. It's got Timothy Dalton being Timothy Dalton. It's got Eva Green. Now, in the first episode, I'm like, this is a criminal waste of Eva Green. She's just sitting there. What are they doing? Then the second episode comes on. It's like, oh, my God. This show is great. If you're not watching it, it is only eight or so episodes. Thank you. There's only eight episodes for the first season. It's available. You can stream it. Hot man-on-man action. Not going to turn that down. Penny Dreadful.
Thank you, Glenn. As all of these guys have been very kind to accommodate, I've been in Los Angeles for the last couple weeks listening to tons and tons of presentations about TV that is coming to you in the fall, in most cases, some of which is being played here. So it's some of the same stuff and then some other stuff. And one of the things that PBS talked about to us was their upcoming Death Comes to Pemberley piece starring Matthew Rhys of The Americans as Darcy. If you're not familiar with Death Comes to Pemberley, it's a P.D. James novel that follows Elizabeth and Darcy after the events of Pride and Prejudice, and there's a mystery that takes place at Pemberley. And the point of this is that after they presented this panel, they gave us copies of the novel, because it's PBS, they give you books. I did not take all of them because I did not have a trunk to ship home. But I did take Death Comes to Pemberley, and I read it, just finished it this morning. I don't know if I loved everything about it, but what I did really like about it is there is a sort of a turn that it takes late in the book where you begin to really understand that part of what she's trying to do is address her frustrations about Pride and Prejudice, which, of course, you know, hundreds of years old now. It's a really fascinating, I think people who don't understand why people enjoy writing fan fiction, people who don't understand why people like extending stories, changing them, tweaking them. It's a very interesting way. You can, especially in the epilogue, you can really understand that this is in part an exercise motivated by what she has always found unsatisfying about that book. And yet it's this massive act of love. And to me, reading that book is such a great, it's such a great experience in seeing that the people who love things the most are often people who want them to do things differently. And that is a really important contradiction to keep in your head as you read criticism, as you read fan reaction. It's not a matter of haters versus fanboys versus whatever. Ideally, true enthusiasm has this great element of love and also this great element of striving for things to be better and smarter and to address the things they haven't addressed. So I found it really wonderful in that way, and that is very much making me happy this week. So P.D. James, Death Comes to Pemberley, it's been out for a couple years, and I very much enjoyed reading it. So as we wrap up our panel today, first of all, thanks to all of you guys for coming. It's really amazing that with... Thank you. That with the sheer quantity of stuff that there is here, it's so thrilling and so incredibly moving to us that you guys would take time...
that anyone showed up.
That you guys would take time and come, and we're so grateful. And the show is such a labor of love for us. We're thrilled that people have... That's a Jane hat. Sorry.
I understood that reference.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I wrote like a billion word thing that had Jane hats in it. For us, the support of everybody who listens to the show is so important and has been so great for us and is everything that has kept the show moving. And I want to tell you one other thing, which is sound engineer over there recording the... Some of you know, but some of you don't. Sound engineer over there recording with the hopes that we can actually make this an episode of the podcast, assuming that we've managed the disclaimer correctly. That's Petra Mayer.
Woo!
We have a long tradition on the show of having people produce, do audio, and help us on the technical side, who are also fantastic contributors to the show. We're so grateful to Petra for being willing to, even though she's got a full plate of stuff she's doing at Comic-Con, has been a wonderful contributor to the podcast, but she was also willing to be our sound engineer today. And we encourage all of you, if you see Petra, by all means, chat up Petra. She's doing some terrific stuff for NPR while she's here. She's wonderful to just talk to. She is the only one of us who does the costume thing. So, you know, she is of Comic-Con in a way that none of the rest of us are. So we're just very, very grateful for having Petra in the room and helping us out. Thank you, ma'am. Woo. And I think before we hustle out, we can probably do like one question.
Sure, yeah.
Ask us a question.
Okay, I have two quick questions. The first question I have is that I listened to your podcast right after Frozen came out. And I remember you guys were kind of like, meh. And Glenn said something about how drag queens were just going to embrace that song. Mm-hmm. And then that song and the movie just went nuts. And I also remember that Glenn likes to say that familiarity breeds contempt. So I'm wondering, do you think that will happen with Frozen? And has the bursting forth of popularity with that movie made you take a second look at it? Or are you still kind of like,
go ahead.
Me first. If you know any parents of young children, they're already at the contempt for Frozen.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned this before. I think I mentioned on the podcast that I have seen the movie again. The lack of the kind of jokes that I was expecting from it bothers me less. The song, which, by the way, when I say drag queens embrace it, I don't mean that everybody else can't. I just mean drag queens are going to embrace it.
Which happened.
It's not an ownership thing. Everybody can have it. They're just going to have it in a very different way.
Sure.
So I do like the movie, and I see some of the points that Linda was making about how it's trying to subvert in a very Disney-fied way. It's trying to subvert some things that Disney does.
Yeah, I was very distracted by just another princess movie. What does it have to be a princess? Oh, it's feminist, blah, 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 but it's still a princess. Why is it a princess? And that was not drowned out by any enthusiasm from my own children. I have the one 10-year-old daughter who doesn't give a crap about that movie.
I have a 4-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
She rebels against everything. It's popular. She's also like a super Bieber hater and all that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. One Direction, oh, they suck. But I definitely, like, once I saw a lot of outpourings of people who were like, there aren't movies like this. There aren't movies that chronicle this kind of sibling relationship. And when I saw that, I felt like I missed the boat on a lot of that stuff, because I was, like Glenn, was focused on jokes. I didn't necessarily have kids freaking out about it the way they freaked out about...
So the second time was definitely like, okay, I'm seeing a little bit more.
Yep. Yeah, I get it. I get okay. it. I overstated my reservations. I recant my reservations.
Thank okay. you so much. I want to take one super quick one from my pal back there who says he has a question.
Hey, come on up, Alan.
Who's going to run up here. I don't know if you know who this guy is. This is Alan Sepinwall, television critic. Woo. And pal of mine, personally.
Every time I listen to one of these trivia questions, it seems unfair to me that Glenn does not have to actually answer one himself. So,
all right, then.
Since we are talking about sidekicks, this is a two-pronged challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Can you A, explain how the Falcon used to be a pimp, and B, do it in a way that does not make Linda laugh?
Excuse
boy.
Me. And finally, please be aware that many members of your audience may be under 18 years of age.
This is a question I would get completely wrong, because that is a big hole in my knowledge, is that era of Marvel Comics. I just don't have it, explain to us, Alan.
It was the Cosmic Cube.
Of course it was.
But, all right, okay, fine, second one then.
Yeah.
Which member of the Teen Titans was not originally a sidekick?
Okay, you got your Speedy, he was a sidekick. You got your Wonder Girl, who was actually a younger version of Wonder Woman when she was first introduced. You got your Robin, who was a sidekick. And you got Aqualad, who was a sidekick. So I'm going to have to say Wonder Girl.
Wonder Girl, yeah. It was a mistake that yep. they thought she was a sidekick when she was supposed to be the younger
there
version
you go.
Of Wonder Woman.
I was going to do a Wonder Tot question along those same lines.
All right.
I appreciate it,
you
Alan.
Got it right.
Thank you very much. We can grab one more quick one.
One more question. Kathy, how about Kathy? I get to pick Kathy.
Aside from the panels that you're going to be on, what panel here at Comic-Con do you most want to attend?
Ooh. Quick draw.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if we'll be able to get in because that's one of the long line ones, but it's not a Hall H. And if you have never seen Quick Draw and you are at Comic-Con, oh, my gosh. So
yeah, it's the one panel you'll find here at Comic-Con. You won't find it at any other science fiction convention.
Right. Absolutely. And so you have Sergio Aragonés doing cartoons that Mark Evanier challenges him. Two
and
other artists.
And they're doing it on overhead projectors?
Yes, so that you can see all the different cartoons. And while other people are laboring for hours doing them, Sergio's
And Mark
doing...
is sadistic in what he asks these guys to draw.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly like to see that. I'd like to see panels with with voice actors, particularly from cartoons I watch. There's an Archer function on Friday at 5 that I don't even know what it entails. It literally could just be watch the episodes of Archer you watch at home, and I intend to be there.
For me, I already saw it. It was the Bill Finger panel this morning. Bill Finger was the uncredited co-creator of Batman, and he got his due. He's dead now, but his family was there, and there were all these professionals saying, this guy got a raw deal, and it was standing room only, which is very, very encouraging. Amid all this hype, amid all this enthusiasm, an uncredited creator who gave the world pretty much everything we know about Batman could get his due.
Fantastic. I have been thinking only about this and crowds. So I am going to be looking for stuff. I absolutely cannot claim that I've made up a schedule for myself. I am pitiful in that way. I was doing this other thing, and now I'm doing this, and I'm so happy to be like relatively upright that I cannot claim to have any great plans.
There's this amazing thing going on in a hotel bathtub out by the airport.
Yeah, that's my plan. My panel is going to be looking at the wall. But I will try to find some awesome stuff. I'm just devoid of good ideas because I haven't really looked yet. Thank you so much. All right, you guys. Thank you so much. This has been great fun. We really appreciate it. We'll be walking around with buttons, and hopefully we'll see some of you on Saturday. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. There are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Intelligence Squared US, Oxford-style debates recorded live in New York. After listening to the world's leading authorities sharing surprising facts and reasoned analysis, you just might rethink your point of view on some big issues. Find Intelligence Squared US on iTunes under podcasts.